would you like to see in a book about the psychiatric survivors movement, or in my book?
Well, I'd like to see how it's related to other movements that are currently, other liberation movements that are currently happening in society. That's one thing. I'd like to see what it has in common with other movements, if any. And I can't right now think of any other movements, but, you know, the examples that have been used, but those are 60s examples. The women's movement, the black liberation movement, the gay liberation movement. Okay, is this where the psychiatric survivors movement is? Is it at that stage where these movements were at then? Is it beyond that? Where is it at? I'd like to know what it is. What it is today. I'd like to know what you think it is from going and speaking to these people. I'd like to know what your view of it will be, and I think that'll give me a better view. I'd like to understand that because I don't have the time. I don't know anybody who'll do what you're doing now, and I think that is invaluable. So in a sense, what I'd like to see from your book is your book. I'd like to see what you come up with once you've seen all these people, whether you do see the outlines of a movement, whether you see the highway, the connections between people that can be used, you know, like by information, blah, blah, blah. We were talking earlier, I don't know if it was taping about information. I think you'd asked me what's necessary.
What would accelerate it, I said.
And I said, I think I answered information flowing through the system. That's how you increase, you know, like I'm using this little analogy, it's stupid, but bear with me for a second. Family therapy, the system. What is the role of the therapist? It's to increase information, to transmit, to increase the flow of information in the system that reorganizes things. So I think that's apt for the psychiatric survivors movement. More information is needed. Now, who's going to be doing that? I think you are in a privileged position to do that, really.
When I asked you the question before, you said you'd like to see a self-sustaining movement created.
Yeah, I'd like you to show us how to create.
Why do you think I'd know how?
Well, why wouldn't you? I mean, you're thinking about it. You're spending time thinking about it.
Okay.
You go and you're asking people what they think. You're
going
to get a lot of it.
So
you're going to get much more out of this than you even think.
I hope so. So you want me to provide a blueprint for creating a self-sustaining movement and you...
Self-correcting.
Self-correcting.
Not necessarily self-sustaining. It may...
Which
it
learns
may,
from its mistakes and persists and
yeah.
which doesn't...
And persists and may decide to stop and may decide to die and may just live it. But that's not the point. The point is as long as it doesn't just go... You know, in this one direction, then bang, funding is cut, it dies. No, it has to anticipate. For example, like Paul here was talking, every time you asked him the thing, what's good, he said, what's good? What was real good? The government recognized.
Yeah.
What do you think? Well, if the government gives us. So he talked a lot about the government. Now, I mean, is this what the movement needs? Funding from the government? Well, maybe. Recognition from the government? Maybe. I don't know.
Mm.
But so in a sense, a self-correcting movement would anticipate that. Well, the government's not always going to be there,
right.
Or it's not always going to have the attitudes. So what, you know, what is a movement, given the system as it is today? What's a movement like that supposed to function? Is it always supposed to expect money from the government? Where else is funding supposed to come? Who's, you know, so this is what I
yeah,
would like
does
to
it
see.
Need money? How much money does it need? Why
right,
does it need money?
Right,
yeah.
Why does it need money?
Yeah.
That's those kinds of issues. I believe it does need money, but... The fact that the simple
I
of let's go for the government,
that
however,
it doesn't need a lot of money to in
no,
order to have
no,
some
no,
efficacy.
No, but it needs official recognition. That's a big challenge. It needs official. It has to be counted as one of the partners. That's the thing. Now, just that will channel to it resources that are today not available. Now, it suffers major disadvantage. A paper and a presentation of Michael McCubbin, who's my student and colleague, and I wrote and are writing now in presentations we made, we look at imbalances of power between client groups and psychiatrists and other professionals. And clients suffered systematic disadvantages with respect to psychiatrists in a number of things. One of the main ones is psychiatrists benefit from external funding advantages. That is, I don't know of any drug company that is going to survive to fund a psychiatric survivor movement.
Right.
But they will fund doctor associations and conferences and seminars, but they will not fund your seminars. they will not. Okay, but that, you see, of course, but why is it that way? Is there anything logical to that? No. There's nothing rational or logical about that. Why should these professional groups have access to such funding? Why should families have access to such funding? Why not patient groups?
Because all of this is about social control.
Yes, but the fact is, let's say it explicitly, let the policymakers realize that, which they don't often. In other words, there has to be a recognition. A patient group, to me, has to keep putting forth the fact that the mental health system does not meet the needs of its ostensible clients. That's really the main point. Because the unstated assumption, and again, this is a point Michael McCubbin makes a lot, and I've learned from him, the unstated assumption in all of the writings is that there's this mental health system that works because it has input from these caring professionals and loving families trying to help clients. I mean, that's the unstated assumption by everybody. And the only people who question that are some crazy, sympathetic professionals here and there, and a few ex-patients and survivors. That's it. Now, that point of view to me is extremely legitimate, but it has to get across more solidly. That's the one point that needs to get across. The system doesn't work for the clients. I mean, the fact is that...
But can one state categorically that it doesn't work if a bunch of people who've been through it say it worked for me? Can you not... I mean, how can you say it doesn't work?
It's not designed. It's not designed. The playing field is not level. There's complete systematic power imbalances due to so many factors, some of which are correctable, others are not necessarily. But, you know, drug company funding of all these psychiatric activities, there's nothing rational, nothing fair, nothing logical, nothing ethical about it. Nothing. And that to me is some, for example, is something that should be tackled. There's nothing, believe me, there's nothing fair about it. There's no reason.
I believe you that there's nothing fair.
And, but yet it goes on. Why? Because people all believe that they're all these other actors are united in this common goal. But there is not a common goal. There's different goals, different ways of going about it. Now, to you say, yeah, I know that, but that's what we're trying to get across. Well, I think that the patients' movement, I call it patients just because it's
okay.
Easier that
Don't worry
way,
about terminology.
Has been busy trying to survive, trying to organize. It's thought very often locally. Professionals that have been involved on very specific issues. You need to really move into the big leagues. The movement has to move into the big leagues.
Tell me what you mean by that. I'm just going to move this microphone.
It has to... It has to tackle the decision makers. It has to have a big, you have to hire sharp analysts, policy analysts. Turning?
Yeah.
People who are into policy making, who can analyze the laws and so on and devise strategies for, you know, changing the playing field, the policy making field in mental health. You know, it's like you need public relations people, etc. That's for that. I believe money is needed, you know. I don't think
money certainly needed if that's what you're gonna do.
But to me that is part of it. It's not just, you know, raising consciousness and putting out a drug guide, because putting out a drug guide is nothing. The most important thing is getting publicity, getting reviews, getting radio shows to talk with a drug guy. It's not the drug guy. I realize that. The drug guy itself is nothing. It's people talking about it.
Right.
People and people paying attention to it. People saying, gee, maybe I'll get it. Maybe I'll call. Okay, so that's... And I think the patient movement has to be at the stage where it can begin to look for outside experts to advise it on things. It has to, you know, not just say... Okay, let's get together. It's just us. The more of us, the stronger. The more we feel solidarity, our cause is true, we'll win. Things are too fragmented. You really need And I mean experts in certain fields, in public relations, in advertising. You need to be able to have posters in Metro Toronto buses that say mental illness is this, or that say drugs are that. Just like, you know, some other coalition of concern of the Clark Institute can advertise for a chair in psychiatry and then have a free page by the Globe and Mail, then that's what you gotta be getting.
Okay.
You gotta have your free page in the Globe and Mail. Now, how do you get that? But that's what the movement has to do. Anything else will not do. So that's what I mean by the major leagues.
Okay.
It has to do that real quickly. It can't just start, it has to just go right in there.
Okay.
It's a big agenda, huh?
Yes.
Well, it starts with a grant, you know, it starts with one grant and the tape recorder, and then you never know. The story is simply that I undertook a study of neuroleptic prescription practices by physicians in the province of Quebec. And it was a questionnaire survey of about 3,000 practicing physicians, about 1,000 psychiatrists, and 1,000 general practitioners.
And you did this as a professor at the University of Montreal?
Yeah, as a professor at the University of Montreal. It's part of my interests and work as a researcher. And funded by, you know, various granting agencies, federal, provincial, medical, social. And when my questionnaires were sent, the board of directors of the Quebec Association of Psychiatrists sent a letter to its 1,000 or so, all its members.
Which is where your questionnaire went, yes?
Where part of my questionnaire went. My questionnaire went to four different specialties, including 1,000 psychiatrists.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they didn't like my questionnaire. They didn't like, forget the questionnaire, they didn't like that the study was being done. So they sent out a letter saying, well, for various reasons, he's not a doctor. There's no doctor working with him. And we think he's biased. We urge you not to participate in the study. Now, this notwithstanding the fact that my study had been approved by the highest ranking by the Professional Corporation of Physicians of the province of Quebec. Its president had given me an enthusiastic letter of support that was appended to every questionnaire. Plus, I had gotten approval from the Dean of Research of the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Montreal. You know, written letters saying each one of these bodies had carefully looked at the project and the questionnaire and had recommended it, had endorsed it. Endorsed it to the extent of saying that it would help medical services in mental health in Canada. Well, what happened was simply that I was, this letter went out to all these psychiatrists and publicly, you know, sort of saying, implying and saying specifically that they had reason to believe, the board of directors had reason to believe that I was biased. I was not an objective researcher. Now that is probably the strongest, the worst accusation that can be made against a researcher, that you're not objective. Now what does that imply? What does it imply? That you're going to falsify data? You're going to consciously misinterpret things? That you're going to let your biases blind you to obvious things? That you're not going to be honest? Now that is devastating, and it's like saying, you know, it's like saying to a, Catholic priest that he goes and tells on what's being told to him at confession. And he, you know, I mean, it's I can't imagine a worse thing. There was no scandal, really. I didn't take it very far. I got legal help from the University of Montreal to counteract this. However, my study had to stop because with this letter going out to all these psychiatrists, the conditions of the research changed immediately, so I had to stop everything. However, I did get, before that letter went out, over a third of the psychiatrists responded to my sample.
Wow.
And over a third of the GPs also responded. So in essence, I ended up with a very, very healthy sample of about 600 doctors, which is quite a fair amount.
and which is in fact very representative of my population. Now, what this problem did is it means that I was not able to do follow-ups. I was not able to keep asking for questionnaires because, you know, they wouldn't work, you know. So my response rate is not what I want it to be. But it's in the 40% rate, you know, which is quite good for a questionnaire on a very sensitive topic, which is tardive dyskinesia. The questionnaire and the study had to do with trying to elicit from practicing physicians how they would prescribe neuroleptics to schizophrenic patient of various ages with various degrees of tardive dyskinesia and presenting various schizophrenic symptoms. The idea was to find out whether these doctors are aware of the risk factors for tardive dyskinesia and how they deal with these risk factors and how they prescribe the drugs to various types of patients. I'm just now, because of this problem, took me it wasted a whole year of my time, but I'm just now finishing the data analysis for that. It doesn't look very good for most doctors. Not at this point because, you know, again, only when everything's finished I can talk about it publicly,
okay.
But I can't really.
Okay. So tell me more about the outcome of the problem.
The outcome of the problem was I think quite good for me. I believe that the only impact, I think, negative impact I think it's had, first of all, is that clearly in the medium term future I cannot do another survey of Quebec psychiatrists. I mean, you know, I'm burned, okay, for whatever reason. However, and also I'm still stocking thousands of questionnaires that were supposed to be sent, so that's wasted money from the taxpayer.
Yeah.
It's not my money, it was funded by the taxpayer, funded this research. Not a lot of money, but a few thousand dollars. However, I believe that since that episode, there's been no negative impact on my career. Like I said, I got tenure that very same year. I asked for tenure, got accelerated tenure. I've got more grants on drug-related subjects than I can probably use. I'm more and more in demand for consultation on these issues. I'm director of a research center. I'm involved in supervising and consulting with biomedical research agencies. So,
what's the research center called?
GRASP, Groupe de Recherche sur les Aspects Sociaux de la Santé et de la Prévention, which means literally research group on the social aspects of health and prevention. We call it Health and Prevention Social Research Group in English.
So this attempt to discredit you backfired rather severely?
I don't know if it backfired against the people who tried to, who did it, but it didn't hinder me as much as I thought it would. Now, I don't know what effect it's had on them, probably very little. But it hasn't had long-term negative effects on me. However, it did have a major psychological chilling factor. When it happened, it was a big chill factor. You know, I was a young, untenured professor accused by a major, powerful professional association of being unbiased. And all its members got a letter just about me. It's a memo, one-page memo, read David Cohen. So it's really, you know, this, and I got a copy too, and it was very chilling.
I bet.
So it did stop me for a long time, and it did put me behind a lot of my work, but that was, you know, it lasted about a year. It's been okay since then. It's made me stronger. I'm working on legal analysis of tardive dyskinesia, legal approaches to understanding tardive dyskinesia in Canada. That is, why there are so few tardive dyskinesia civil suits, considering the number of people that have it, considering that it is, most of them result from, you know, a drug, And most people who take the drugs are not informed that they can get tardive dyskinesia. So considering all this, you'd assume somebody would be suing somebody. But I think there's been one or two cases in Canada. Well, whereas in the United States, there's been more.
Yes.
Now, what, is it just purely the culture of litigation? Or are there particular things here, more specific obstacles? So we're looking at the laws and comparing, at least in the Quebec system with some of the American system, to try to understand why this is happening. But the goal is to try to provide compensation for victims.
Yes.
And for that, you have to first of all bring the issue to the public, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm working on legal issues related to tardive dyskinesia. Now, challenging the therapeutic state to me is one of my, it's what I consider my contribution to the movement.
It is a special issue, two special issues of the Journal of Mind and Behavior.
Exactly.
Which is a respected journal.
Yes, it's a respected psychological journal. It's a scholarly psychological journal which specializes in articles dealing with mind, consciousness, and so on. That's what it specializes in. It doesn't exclusively publish that. But it publishes things on the history of psychology. It specializes in mind, consciousness, the brain, etc. Now, through just this play of circumstances, I don't really know why, but I saw that journal one time. I just found it interesting, and I sent my 1983 paper eventually. It got published in 1986. So through that association, I approached the editor, and I suggested I wanted to do a special issue that would gather, this was in 1988,
mm-hmm.
and I said that would gather the, 1987 I approached him. I wanted to bring together the leading critics of what I call the therapeutic state, what SAS called the therapeutic state, because I thought it was time. All I could see was just more and more talk of biology and mental illness and drugs and DSM, and I said, Jesus, like, what's happened? I mean, you know, is this whole movement of the 60s and 70s been completely recycled? Been completely, like, eaten up? Is it gone? And I said, I don't think it's gone. I'm reading things here. I see people that are still writing about this, so I just attempted to put together the people I knew that had something to say that was critical, and put it out there and make it thoughtful and scholarly. If it, you know, there might be some, it might resonate. So I did that. That came out in 1990. That was pretty, very well received, I think. Fairly well received. Because it had, you know, like people like the original Tom Saz, and it had Andrew Scull. I tried to gather all the streams I could think of criticism in psychiatry. So you had some traditional, some wild-eyed radicals, a couple of ex-patients, and I try to cover treatment, I try to cover ideology, I try to cover women and kids. And this was about 18 or 20 different chapters. And as a result of that, some people contacted me, and I got to know more people, people who were not as well-known, a few more ex-patients or survivors. And the second special issue, which came out in 94, which is smaller, it's about half the size, has about half the pieces from survivors, I think, or also. And they're the same, in the same spirit. If I could, I would have had them in the first issue if I'd known these people. And I believe that together those two represent really practically every kind of strand of criticism of the psychiatric system. I don't think there's really another type of criticism. There's an existential, there's a social control, there's a Sazian, there's the psychological type of criticism, there's sociological, there's legal, there's the Italian, there's the feminist. We got it there. That's the two parts. I think it stands itself. My editor, the guy there at Journal of Mind Behavior, is asking now, he wants a part three for alternatives. I don't know if it's possible per se, but I've begun to think a little bit of a part three, and then, you know, that will be that. But to me, I see that as a way of putting information out there that there are still people who are thinking about it, thinking very seriously about it. And it's not just, you know, wild-eyed radicals. It's all kinds of people.
Mm-hmm.
It's survivors, and it's respected professors in universities. All kinds of people share these ideas. So I really wanted to make them more legitimate, to show that there is a market for them, and there's people producing them. This Anti-psychiatry is not dead, no matter what people say. The stream of thought continues, and it's very varied. That's really all I wanted to do with that. That, to me, is my real contribution to what I would consider the survivor movement, or to the general alternative movement, or the what I call the critical psychiatry movement. It's a piece by John Murawski, and Catherine Ross, maybe. John Murawski, I think, wrote it. And it's called Subjective Distinctions in Psychiatric Diagnosis, or something like that. What John Murawski tried to do is a sociologist who analyzes traditional psychiatric diagnosis, the DSM-4, DSM-3 categories, and finds that, in fact, he comes up with this interpretation that psychiatric troubles, personal people troubles, are something like stars in the sky. That is, you see these phenomena, you see these stars, but we organize them into constellations. Now, there's no such thing as a constellation. It's just what you decide, the links you decide to make between stars. Now, that star doesn't necessarily think of itself as being that constellation, or it doesn't necessarily belong in a constellation, because a constellation is just this picture you've just projected and said, okay, stopping there, this is one constellation, this is another one. But the constellations don't really exist. All there are is the stars in the sky that you see. Well, so he makes this sort of argument that there's a lot of problems, but how we categorize them is purely arbitrary. And he then shows that a lot of the problems, in fact, look a bit like a circle. They fit into a circle with one blending into another. And he has a diagram where he shows you which problem blends into which one. It's very interesting. It identifies what I consider to be the basic types of mental illnesses, in quotations, and how they fit into each other, but not how they're separated from each other. And it's a really different way of looking at troubles, and I think it's a revolutionary type of thing, but it doesn't look revolutionary. It's a study with a sample and a bunch of statistics and things, but it's a very, very important piece.
Right.